You are listening to Help for HD Live, the first podcast created for families living with Huntington's and juvenile Huntington's disease. Don't forget to find us on iTunes, Blog Talk, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. You can also search over 500 archived episodes and other projects at helpforhd.org. To watch us in person, find Help for HD TV on YouTube and subscribe and ring the bell for notifications on new content. Help for HD Live is going on air in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning in to Help for HD Live. This program is made possible because of Teva Pharmaceuticals, Neurocrine Biosciences, and the Griffin Foundation. I'm your host, Lauren Holder, and today I have Tom Hart on with us. He is with the Critical Path Institute, which started from the FDA. And today we are going to be talking about something I'm really excited about, something I've been wanting to talk about for a while, and that is the Act for ALS and what it is and basically how it doesn't just support ALS, it also supports the HD community. So I'm really excited to have Tom on today. Tom, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, no problem, Lauren. Glad to be here.
So before we go into the Act for ALS, can you kind of share a little bit about yourself and how you came to be with Critical Path Institute?
Yeah, mine is a very non-traditional journey. So I'm a lawyer by training. I graduated from the University of Miami School of Law. And while I was there, I focused in health equity issues. I have a family member with a rare disease. And so advocacy has been a part of my life for decades now. And I wanted to use my background in understanding the healthcare system, as well as my legal education, to help other people and other families. And so I started by working at the University of Minnesota School of Law after graduating. And there I led public interest law programs, worked for Blue Cross Blue Shield Association for a number of years doing disability rights work, and then ended up at CPAP because I was really trying to understand all the pieces of the puzzle, the different legs of the stool in healthcare. And pharma and the research part just seemed so foreign and disconnected from what was happening with providers and payers. And so I spent about a year and a half cutting my teeth learning how drug development and research happens. And then I joined CPATH. I'm actually the first ever director of outreach for the organization. My role was created through the public-private partnership, which we'll talk about, enacted as part of the Act for ALS. And so I focus all of my effort connecting to the rare disease community, focusing rare neurodegenerative disease and ALS, which is
That's
a lot.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I mean, it just shows, you know, so glad to have you in that space. So let's go into what Critical Path Institute is. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure thing. So CPATH was created about 15 years ago. The idea was that there needed to be a nonprofit partner who could act as this convener. FDA does the regulation of medicine. NIH does the research into health. But there wasn't a neutral convener that could work closely with industry, both here domestically in the US and globally, to connect all those different partners in a space where there weren't conflicts of interest. And so CPATH was created to be that neutral convener. It is what I like to think of as the experts' experts. So people in the community may not know it very well, but if you're talking to somebody who's in charge of R&D within industry, if you're talking to a regulator or an academic institution, those are the people that we tend to work with. And the goal there is really to bring together all the different partners in a pre-competitive space and then begin to do this work group, task group. It really starts very early on with landscaping and natural history studies, and then we begin to sort of spin off those tools that industry uses when they move to clinical trials and right that sort of thing that we're more familiar with. So CPATH is the an agonist, I guess, or an actor that helps to move research forward and expedite things through the approval process. It took me a long time to understand it as well. And I think the most like clear understanding of what CPATH does is when I looked at the different consortia. So there are 39 different consortia under CPATH's umbrella. I work for rare neurodegenerative diseases, but that's just one. We actually have a specific consortia in Huntington's disease. We work with ataxias and Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. We just wrapped up work in sickle cell and on transplants. So it really spans the whole spectrum in the health research space.
Awesome. Yeah, I just learned about all of that when I went to the World Orphan Drug Congress in Boston. Just I was very interested to see all of the different consortia and all of the stuff that CPATH is doing currently. Especially there was a database that they mentioned and all kinds of stuff. So it's really
Yep.
exciting. So
Exactly.
let's talk about the Act for ALS. I do a horrible job of explaining it, so I am going to let you explain it. I've done quite a bit of research, but you are the expert, so I'm going to let you have at it.
Oh gosh. Okay. So here's the deal. The Act for ALS is a giant document. And it is complicated. So I don't expect everybody to have understanding and expertise really quickly. But maybe the most important part is to sort of understand the components of the Act for ALS. And so there's a few different buckets. And the way I think about it, well, let's start with the beginning. So it was signed into law the end of December 2021 by President Biden. And so it's a fairly recent bill. It appropriated a big chunk of money. I think it was like $100 million for ALS research. And that was per year for 5 years. And at the end of those 5 years, there's going to be a study done to demonstrate the effectiveness of that funding in moving research forward for ALS. But what's important is that though it's, we're going to talk a lot about ALS, we're going to use that a lot. It's important to understand that it's not just ALS, that it's really rare neurodegenerative diseases. And inside of the bill and in the language, and FDA talks about this a lot in their action plan, we don't know a lot about rare neurodegenerative diseases. And that research that's being done does overlap. And the infrastructure that's being built to accelerate this research, though it may start with ALS, or ALS may be sort of the first beneficiary, it will not be the only one. And so there are key components of this work that tie directly to what's going on in Huntington's disease. And so I think it's kind of important for the HD community to know and be engaged and continue to be supportive of what's happening as we're nearing that point where they're going to begin talking about reauthorizing the Act for ALS and what the next 5 years of research would look like. So, the first thing the Act for ALS did was create a grant for research on therapies specifically for ALS. So that meant that there was a big chunk of money allocated for extended access protocols or extended access programs for drugs that were in phase three clinical trials. I think that one's interesting because we've had a couple of drugs pulled back from the market. And so I'm kind of waiting to see what updates we get in that space. But it also created a public-private research partnership, and that's where CPATH comes in. So the act really named FDA and NIH, which are two different agencies inside of Health and Human Services in the government. And they're instructed to work together to create this public-private partnership, which is the vehicle through which all the funding is going to be driven. And that includes the public private partnership with CPATH, and CPR&D was created through that, and that's directly through FDA on our side of things. And then there's an AMP for ALS, which is another effort that's being stood up by NIH. And all the partners are in the AMP, but that's really just accelerated research for ALS. And then there's ALS, which is a consortium model that all this different research is getting organized underneath. Because right now there are COAs being identified. Those will lead to endpoints. We'll potentially review biomarkers. There's digital health technologies and some other tools that may come into place. And each of those will be a work group that'll be organized through this structure that's been set up. And it can get a little bit confusing to hear all of those different pieces, but I think if you can imagine sort of a house, and these are the different floors of the house, and they all stand up together to get us closer to an effective treatment for ALS. But again, as we're doing all of that and we're building all of this infrastructure, the idea is to move other rare neurodegenerative diseases through that same infrastructure. So, though it might start with ALS research, some of those same biomarkers, some of the same digital health technology tools can be applied to research in other areas as well.
Yeah, and that's what I was reading earlier, just on the FDA website, where specifically I was looking at the grant program, and as you said, like throughout this whole thing, even though it's the Act for ALS, it says for ALS and other rare neurodegenerative diseases. So this does mean that we as an HD community can be eligible for those grants and for the other programs that come out of this.
Yes. And that, so the FDA grant program is really interesting because those are dollars to help organize communities and get sometimes very early sort of research pieces toward a pre-consortium model. Right, so that it's easier for researchers to work with community, and I think that there are specific dollars allocated to like youth impacting diseases. So there are definitely places where the HD community should be plugged in and continuing to engage with FDA, and me and the team at CPATH inside of the HD Risk Consortia, because we're the front line, right? We're the folks who are really trying to build those bridges to community, make sure that people know about these grant opportunities, and to take your input so that we can start to build out and understand what's happening with the community and with researchers. There's oftentimes sort of a fragmented research space where dollars might be allocated through a private funder or through a university research consortia, and a specific scientist might go out with his lab and do some research, and then publish that to advance science. And that's sort of been the traditional model. But with rare diseases, we really need to work more in communication and collaboration together, because those different pieces that happen aren't necessarily all getting reported up through the process. And sometimes individual research can be really groundbreaking, and everybody needs to know about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things I've noticed too, especially in the past couple of years, is I started really getting into research and really looking back at, what's been done in HD as far as HD research goes. There's a lot of things I didn't know and a lot of individualized things, right, that didn't move forward. And so knowing those things, that's a big deal. So I love that though, that we can now collaborate with you guys to be able to know opportunities, because that's what I'm hearing, right? So we can actually contact you and ask, like, what areas should we be looking at? Is there funding that we should be considering, you are able to help kind of provide that information and education on that, correct?
So there's a couple of different ways, right? So I'm one front door, I suppose. Tarina Martinez, who is my colleague and is the executive director of our HD Risk Consortia, is sort of the other piece of this puzzle. And that HD Risk Consortia, it's been around for a while. They're continuing to do work. I think that there's actually a lot of, because of the passage of the Act, there's much more in attention from industry and researchers on the space. Which makes sense because there's now dollars available. People are interested in pursuing that. And so that means that the community has so many new avenues for engagement. And it can be a little overwhelming to talk to all of these people. And, just in my personal advocacy experience, I'll say it was always really frustrating because, in my family, we were trying to manage hope and optimism and sort of that resilience. When you're dealing with a long-term chronic illness, with what was being promised and talked about. And it felt like pie in the sky promises. And I tried just to keep my sort of skeptical head in, but I also really just wanted to believe, right? Like, if I do this work, we're going to cure this disease. And I think that cures are possible and are valuable, but there's so much talk. It can get distracting, right? Because you don't know where to draw that line for trust. I think that what CPATH offers is pure science, right? But I'm the only non-scientist who works for CPATH, basically. So I'm dealing with the scientists every day, and they think about things incrementally in changes, right? These what sometimes feel like really small wins actually end up meaning a lot. And so staying focused on that part of it, staying focused on your engagement as a community, it becomes so incredibly important that the community talks, it works together, and that there be regular opportunities for communication because the what I see happen is a group of researchers or regulators will come to me and say, we need to get a panel of people together from the advocacy community because we have questions. And I'm like, okay, great. Let's do that. But that can take months to get that up and running. If the advocacy community is meeting and talking regularly and they're already having monthly or biweekly meetings or whatever the case may be, it's very easy to be able to say, hey, 2 meetings out from now, we're going to bring in some researchers. They have some questions. I'll share a slide deck in advance so everybody can research it. Come with your questions, come with your input. We're going to sit down and have that conversation. And that can save 6 months at a time, right, from that work timeline. And you do that 2 or 3 times, and all of a sudden you're a year ahead. Right. Those
Yeah,
are,
and that's huge.
and that's the way that I think advocacy staying engaged becomes so important. And that's always the thing I keep in the back of my mind when, because there are times where it's really disappointing, right? In ALS, we just had one of the new drugs pulled off the market. It didn't pass trial. And so there's been, a lot of frustration and heartbreak. And I always remind people, yes, but get together and talk about that frustration. Don't stop showing up to meetings. Don't stop communicating because there's more work being done. We're going to come back to you soon. Like this continuing to show promise. And so that becomes really, really important. I'm glad that you and other advocates are continuing sort of holding that space together because I'm really looking forward to the day that I get to come back and introduce a team of researchers that, have the next endpoint that they want to look at, or the next biomarker that they're doing, or some exciting research to share, because that day will come soon.
Absolutely. And I'm just so grateful to have you guys now, because I did not realize, how important it was to have that engagement, right? A consistent, regular engagement with you guys in order to make sure that things are moving forward, that you have what you need, because our voice matters. to you guys. You have to have that input in order to be able to go back and say, okay, well, this is what I'm hearing, right? But if you're not hearing anything, how can you share it?
Yeah, exactly. And then what happens is you have people who don't have experience living with the disease, making decisions about what the priorities are for the community, for patients, for caregivers. And that's not ideal. But also it can they miss stuff. Like they miss really important stuff if they don't have your input. And the FDA has published some really extensive guidance on patient-focused drug development. I encourage everybody to go and take a look at it. I view that as like a North Star for me. And so the way that CPAP kind of organizes its engagement is that we are as transparent as we can be, right? Almost all of our public meetings are posted to our YouTube channel. The slide decks are posted to the website so you can review everything. I'm always reminding people, please send your questions. Please reach out to me. And even if you're frustrated about something or we totally messed something up, like let me know as soon as you can because I'll do my best to get this addressed. And I wasn't sure coming in exactly how that would be, right? I haven't worked with scientists in this way before. And I will tell you, to a person, they are all ecstatic to hear even bad news from the advocacy community because you're there, you're finally there, and they have this venue now where they can talk to real people and get real input. And oftentimes it helps clear stuff up.
Yeah, that's awesome. And it's one of the things, especially, this is airing during HD Awareness Month. This is such a huge thing. Because as I was trying to tell people, I did a video last week after going to the World Orphan Drug Conference, and I said, even if it's 5 minutes, right? Even if it's just sharing your story. And giving that input or saying that I have permission to share the story, it matters because of what you just said. You need that type of input. And especially with us, we actually do have a patient-focused drug development meeting coming up in late 2024. And so as we prepare for that, it's even more important to make sure that we have all sides of HD, the real HD, and that we're not just showing, especially when it comes to pre-symptomatic and pre-manifest, those with cognitive symptoms but no movements. Like, people need to know the real HD in that space. And so our voice really matters right now.
And I encourage everybody who can participate in that public meeting to show up. I'm not sure if they're going to do like a hybrid virtual or how it's structured yet, but engaging with your advocacy groups so that you have I like joke about this. I'm like every advocate should be walking around Washington, D.C. with like a Type 5 memorized, right? Because if you get 5 minutes attention from a regulator while you're stuck in an elevator or you're in line in Starbucks, just spout it out. Just go for it. Have a business card. Send the email. Whatever you need to do. Find them on LinkedIn. But like grab those opportunities because they're always looking for chances to learn from you. And these public meetings and the public input that we put together in written format is really valuable because we can go back and we can reference it and we can follow up with additional questions when that's appropriate. But continuing to engage and continuing to let researchers know that they're not, doing this work in a vacuum and that real people want to be connected and will benefit from it. It's super important. And it's also like, for whatever it's worth, research is not easy work. It's like 90% failure. And so reminding them that there's a clock ticking on their life on lives, right? That this research is going to change somebody's life for the better helps to keep them focused and kind of battle that sense of hopelessness and that sense of frustration that, oh, we've done 3 months down this line of research and this it didn't work out. And now we have to go back to, the square one and start again. That's great, actually, because we've now ruled something out, but it can be really frustrating and disheartening, especially for somebody where that's their what they do all day, So that engagement actually serves multiple purposes and really emboldens creative thinking and problem solving.
So what I'm hearing is action items for us would be keep engaging, have regular engagement, keep talking with CPath, keep have your elevator pitch ready, that type of thing, because it matters, especially as we start to prepare for this PFDD meeting coming up later this year. Tom, let me ask you, is there anything in particular right now that you're working on for HD that's just really exciting for you?
There's a couple of there's a few things I can talk about. And first, this is broader than just HD, but I think that the HD community will benefit first from it. So the FDA, CPath, and NORD got together and they've created an educational series, webinars that you can take that explain patient-focused drug development for the average person. They're well done. I think the first series is out and the next one is coming out really soon. We're like final editing, and there's another piece of the puzzle that'll come out this summer. But you can begin now and you can take the first certificate today if you want to. I will share the link to that so you can share it with everybody. If you're interested in advocacy, this is something everyone should be doing because it will give you some of the jargon and tools so that you'll understand the process a little bit better. You'll understand some of the jargony language that gets used by industry and regulators. And it'll help you to understand where and how to be the best advocate that you can be, which I think would be great across the board. But you're right, because there is this public meeting that's been set for the future, this is the time for the HD community to get those certifications, to sort of understand and begin to collectively within your advocacy groups have some of those conversations, identify those priorities, and begin sort of talking about them publicly so that at meeting time, there's a good baseline set, and you're spending your time talking about what outcomes are coming next and what you want to see and how you want to be a participant in the next steps of the process. I really do believe that HD is sort of on this precipice point. So, there's a lot of stuff in R&D that is, but this is like an incredible opportunity to get your foot in the door, get talking with the FDA, get the attention of industry and researchers who have some new tools because the Act for ALS is populating this stuff.
Awesome. I am writing notes because
No
I am going to share
problem.
all of this.
Yes. There's the HD Risk Consortia has like three or four work groups that are spinning up. They're submitting some materials for approval. So there's a lot happening in the space, and having the education so you can track some of those reports that are coming out from the consortia. It's just really helpful. And I work with Tarina really consistently to make sure that the consortium is sort of imbued with advocacy. Historically, this wasn't done. And one of the reasons why I'm at CPath is because when my family was first encountering rare disease and the research world, there was no patient-focused drug development. That wasn't a thing yet, right? And so the structures of research aren't necessarily the easiest. They're not built for people living with a disease to be a part of it. And so that process of sort of making room for yourself is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. And so true. And I just love that you're there, Tom, because of the fact that you come from a rare disease family. So you understand the struggles and the barriers. And that was another thing I mentioned in my video last week is just how the rare disease community is there to fight for us. That's one of the things that I really noticed in the meeting. And I walked up and they're like, how can we help you? What can we do? You know, do you need us to be a voice for you? Do you need us to introduce you? Like, what do you need? And it's people like that, people like you who are there, who are making changes, right? Like, you're part of that change and saying, okay, this is how it's been historically. That's not okay anymore. And we need to find a better way and find a better solution. So I'm so grateful for you.
Thank you. I can only do it because there's amazing work that's been done by advocates like yourself, and honestly, the entire HD community, who demanded that there be space. And so, I get to step in and help to coordinate that, but it's purely because advocates before me were out there knocking on doors and having some sometimes tough conversations with regulators that created that change. And I think as you and your listeners are reading through that FDA guidance on patient-focused drug development, you will see your priorities being reflected, those asks. They're making space for it. And now our job is to make sure that they live up to what they promised.
Absolutely. I want to go back for just a second. You mentioned working groups. So what type of working groups, like what does that mean?
Sure. So I have some slides, and we can figure out if we want to share those or not. But basically, what happens is if you imagine like a flow chart, and on one side you have researchers and industry and people living with the disease, and we'll say the FDA, some other regulators. The consortium is the big picture, right? It's the umbrella. And under that, you have specific focused work groups. And one work group might be running down a natural history study, and another work group might be running down a specific biomarker and its impact. Another working group might have digital health technology. So, you know, all the people who wear their Apple Watches, figuring out if we can identify algorithmically any very early indications of the condition, right? Which is Parkinson's has just done that, right? So the Apple Watch detects shakes in your hand and in your voice earlier than we can hear it ourselves. So, right, that they might be working on figuring out how to create a biomarker out of that. Those different work groups report back to the whole and continue to sort of move the research along. And then that next research might say, okay, so we have this early detected shake from an Apple Watch. So let's figure out if we need to clinically map that and what the trial is going to look like. They take all these different components and pieces from. Some of them are even smaller than work groups. They're called like task groups and meeting groups and things. But they take all these different components to move the whole effort forward. And the idea is that there's a steering committee that's helping to sort of act as like air traffic control for these different efforts inside of the consortia that are meeting. And they're submitting things for regulatory approval as, you know, specific endpoints are being identified. Or right now in ALS, we've done this exhaustive research of hundreds of published literature to identify specific clinical outcomes assessments that are going to be the most effective for the next phase, right? HD's already been through that. So now you're sort of looking at the next step in the process. But those are the sorts of things that happen inside the consortia with these different work groups. What is
Who's part of those work groups?
Well, so that's my next point. Thank you. So it depends. In CPATH Consortia, we have researchers, we have representatives from pharmaceutical companies in the R&D space. So the people who are running their specific lab programs. There are FDA folks that participate in those meetings that help on the regulatory side to help direct and guide. And then to some extent, we have people living with HD, right? We have made space for advocates to come forward and have a role. And that's been very new and different. That's not something that had happened before. And that came about because of the Act for ALS. And so what Tarina and I are working on is figuring out the best way to keep advocates part of the conversation, but not tokenized, right? The one of the things that has happened, I think, over the past few years is I think we've all seen ad boards and these sort of patient engagement opportunities, and it's really just scientists come, there's a PowerPoint, they talk you through it, they ask if there are questions, and then they'll have like two or three specific input opportunities. And then the curtain closes, you don't know what's going on anymore, you're not part of the conversation, and the research continues. And what CPath envisions is the advocacy community and the lived experience of participants being a part of the entire process, beginning to end, that they can dial into the meetings, they can hear what's being said, they can ask questions live, and then being able to offer criticisms and critiques and ask follow-up questions and know really what's going on the whole way through. And so that's been one of the bigger changes. And our ALS and HD consortia are right now, to this day, figuring that out.
That is incredible, in itself. So, how would somebody go about being part of one of those working groups if they were interested?
Yeah, so what you do is you talk to me. And the way that this has been organized historically has been that we have a working group or an advisory group of people from the advocacy community. It includes people living with the disease, it includes caregivers and family members. And we provide them some resources so that they can get up to speed on the work that's being done. And then they can participate in conversations. We, you know, if there's six people on a research group working on a specific biomarker, right? We might add a seat or two, and then from that pool of people, ask for volunteers to select to participate. And then they come back and they report to the rest of the group about what they've learned and what's going on. And there's a discussion, and there's this very iterative feedback process, right? A fair number of those working group meetings are much larger and are open to everybody. But there's always a space for advocates to meet and talk together inside of the consortia. And that way, no matter what, there's always room. It was interesting because one of the first concerns I heard when I proposed that model was, researchers who are like, well, there's going to be like 50 people that show up, and there's only like four of us. And I was like, I promise you that there will not be 50 people showing up and like asking questions, right? Like, we're not going to turn this into a seminar. You're going to have a meeting, there's an agenda, just like always. But now, like, there will be people there asking questions, and it's possible that you'll learn a lot from it. The researchers were a little nervous, and they ended up really appreciating it because the questions were insightful. Some of the misses that were pointed out really impacted some of the research that was being done. It shed a new light on some of the data that they were seeing, and the way that they had been interpreting it wasn't the only way to think about it. And so that sort of thing has actually been really helpful. But the other thing that's happened is the community continues to organize itself. And when you get to a clinical trial point, one of the frustrations in rare disease is getting enough people to enroll in a clinical trial so that it's meaningful, right? And this mechanism almost organically does the recruitment part for clinical trials. So industry is super engaged, they're very interested in being involved. And now you have these people who understand why the clinical trial is happening. They've seen the pieces moving forward to get us there, and they know what's going to come out of it, right? Like, whatever the data is, they know where it's going and they know how it's going to work. So,
That makes a huge difference for a person living with a rare disease, because how am I going to trust anything if I don't know what
right.
where it came from, where it's going, anything? So yeah, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it is empowering for people. And it
Yes.
also, like, I spend a lot of my time doing what I think of as education out, right? That a lot of researchers will have questions, they'll be like, I don't know how to ask this. And they'll be like, well, we can try, and we'll see how it goes. But so often they're just very nervous about engagement with the community, and I don't want them to be afraid of asking questions. I'll take it on, right? I'll ask a question, and if it sounds stupid, who cares? Like, at least the question got asked, and we got some answers. And the same thing with the advocacy community. Sometimes they'll be, frustrated or mistrustful of FDA and government entities, and be like, well, why don't let engage, right? Meet them in their space, and you'll learn about them, and then you can still be mistrustful if you want, but you'll have like really good reasons to be, or you'll learn something and you'll get some additional trust because you'll see the system working. It's been generally really positive. It's not always easy. There's bumps along the way. It's not, simple stuff, but overall, the process is better because the advocates are there and they're asking their questions, and they're continuing to do their work and engage.
Absolutely. Well, Tom, I thank you so much for coming on
Yeah,
and
no
sharing all
problem.
of this information. This is incredible. I've been saying how excited I am about all of this. The community knows me and knows how I am. So, this has been a long time coming as far as getting this information out to the community for them to be able to understand and realize how important it is that we engage and we collaborate. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing.
No problem. And I have one last request, which is if anybody wants to volunteer, if they want to participate in any of this stuff, just reach out to me. And I'm beginning to sort of build those lists as we create an advocacy board. And you can be a part of it. Anyone who's listening can be a part of it. So you have my email address. Just reach out to me. We can have a conversation. I can tell you sort of where we are in the process. And I'm also here to answer questions or make connections if there is somebody you want to talk to.
Thank you, Tom. And for everybody listening, I will have Tom's email for you if you are interested. You can either reach out to me and I will connect you and just kind of send an email so you don't feel as nervous, or if you just want his email, I'm happy to share that with you. But I'll have it there on the show page for you guys to find. But here you have somebody who is willing to help us at CPATH and wants us, to speak, and he has these opportunities. So let's take advantage of that, especially now. As he said, this is the time.
Yep, absolutely. And it makes my day to hear from the community. You don't need to send me a fancy email. Just say hi, tell me who you are and that you want to be involved, and we'll begin to get the ball rolling.
Thank you again, Tom.
Yeah.
For those listening, thank you so much for listening. I hope that you have found this helpful to understand more about CPATH, about the Act for ALS, about advocacy in this space, because it's so important. We do have this meeting coming up. This is our opportunity to have a voice. I mean, this is time is now, guys, and especially during HD Awareness Month. Here we go. Here is a way that you can help. If you're wanting to know of something that you can do for HD Awareness Month, send an email. Send an email to Tom. Let him know that you're interested, or just say hi and share your story so he has it to share with others. And that's all it takes. So thank you guys for listening. And I love you guys and talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit www.helpforhd.org and sign up for our email newsletter to stay up to date on all that is going on at Help for HD. Get social with us and like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, and subscribe to Help for HD TV on YouTube, and ring the bell for notifications.